Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Welcome, everybody, to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. We got another real inspirational, wonderful guest lined up for you tonight. We have Mr. Vic Johnson from As a Man Thinketh. He's got some other websites, and he's got a lot going on. He's going to share his story with us. Vic, thank you very much for taking time out and joining us today.
Todd, I'm excited to be with you guys.
Well, I'm excited to be hearing your story, man. It's been a while. I had you scheduled for a while and really been looking forward to it. So thank you. Let's start right away. I always ask the guests this, and so I guess I'll ask you too. Can you share some of your real early memories growing up, you know, where you're from and what was going on inside of you, things like that?
Well, I grew up in an agricultural family, a rural family. In the early days, I remember living way outside of town and, we went into school, took us 25 minutes to get into school. And I remember kind of living in this isolated area with not a lot of people in it. But it was something that I think in a lot of ways forged a lot of the ideas that I have. I live, for instance, today in a very similar place where it's very quiet and very idyllic, and so kind of made the entire circle here. I was a person who had a lot of curiosity when I was young. Sometimes, as you probably remember as a young person too, that curiosity got me in a lot of trouble. I was not a child who, was one of the quiet people who sat in their desk, and my mother seemed to be down at the principal's office quite a bit. I love sports. I lost my father when I was 8 years old, and that had certainly an impact on my life. But thankfully, I had an uncle who stepped in and was the father figure until my wonderful stepfather came along. And my uncle introduced me to sports of all kinds and took me to my first college game. And all of that had a massive impact on my life, developed a tremendous love for sports, and then went on to play most sports and then end up playing football in college. And all of that because of the desire, you know, that came as an early child. So that's kind of the Cliff Notes version. I don't know how much you want.
Well, no, I just want to know, you know, I like to ask everybody, it's wild. Some people remember like something happening profound when they were 2 years old. Other people knew they wanted to be an artist, like their very first memory, or they've heard stories about being at the piano when they couldn't walk. So I like to ask, it's always interesting and intriguing to me to listen to how people, the way their early thinking kind of was established, yes.
Well, I absolutely believe that has a big impact on everything that you end up doing. Dennis Waitley, in fact, he told me one time that he thinks that you can go back into your childhood, and really find where your real passions are. You know, for people who feel like they're in a rut right now, who they're not happy with what they're doing, and they want to, you know, they don't look forward to getting up every day, and they're looking to make some kind of change, but they're at a loss as to what they should do. You know, he said, look, go back in your childhood, look at what you were passionate about as a child. And, you know, I can even, you know, I'm in personal development today, and I can remember when I was 13 years old, 14 years old, reading magazines and books and things that talked about goal setting. And, you know, I really did not get into it until I was in my early 20s, but I was touched by personal development, in my preteens. And so, you know, to end up in that business, I'm sure has a big connection with what I started as a child.
Yeah, that's wild you say that. That really is wild. And that early you were reading those things and searching. But it's funny, isn't it? I don't know for you if it happened that way, but I believe for most of us, we don't really realize it at the time, you know, growing up with all other things that are going on, trying to fit in, you know, girls, you know, all that stuff. I guess we never really focus on that and really look inside.
No, I think the reason that I was attracted to it was what I thought it could get me. You know, I mean, I don't think any of us, you know, are engaged in personal development just for the pure practice of personal development, I think behind all of that is a motivation. Mm-hmm. There's a need, there's a desire, there's some kind of want. And I think, you know, at that particular time in my life, I wanted to be a sports star, and I wasn't exactly cut out physically at that time to be one. So I was looking for a way to do that. And so I kind of stumbled onto the idea of setting goals and doing things like that. And it was from a motivation of a deep desire and a deep want. And I think that's how a lot of us end up, the process is not as important. The style is not as important as the substance is.
Yeah.
And,
did you have any brothers and sisters growing up? Or your only child?
No, I'm certainly not. Certainly not an only child. The oldest of five.
Yeah.
And I have a very close brother, extremely close in many ways. And he's only 15 months apart from me, but he's also, you know, the best friend I have in the world and always has been. And then I have three sisters.
Mm-hmm. Well, did that put pressure on you growing up, like as the oldest child, or especially once your father passed? I mean, was that? Do you see any of that effect in your?
I never felt any. You know, I do think that, you know, some of the qualities that I've developed came about. You know, I think that I've gravitated toward leadership positions. I've never been, one necessarily to sit in the back row. And I think that being the oldest, being in that position, you know, in many ways prepared me to lead. And I think there's been statistics done that the oldest born is more likely to be a NASA, astronaut, and more likely to succeed here. And I think there's a big benefit to being the oldest. So, I know that my younger sisters got away with a whole lot more than I did, and their life was, I think, in many ways easier than my life was. But I'm thankful to be where I was, and thankful for what it brought me.
Well, you said that you were curious and you got in trouble, and I heard you chuckle like that, and I was kind of relating to that. But then going into sports, and that was kind of your drive and passion. How were you with the discipline aspect of that early?
Well, I mean, I think I'm like most people. I hate it and hated it then and hate it now. I mean, it's kind of contrary to the human organism.
Yeah.
And, we don't necessarily respond well to that. But I think in the early going, when I couldn't see the direct tie between the discipline and the result, you know, again, if there's a motivation there, you'll do, if the motivation, the desire is strong enough, you'll do something you don't want to do. I mean, Napoleon Hill, the very first chapter of Think and Grow Rich, he talks about desire. That's the title of the chapter. He said, it's the most important thing. And, you know, desire is the beginning of all achievement, he says. So if you've got a strong enough desire, then you'll do whatever it takes. And I think that's what happened was I had this desire, even though it crumpled at times and it got very weak. I remember one time I was going to quit. It got so bad. And I had my wonderful stepfather who had also played college sports. And he counseled me in a very nice way without coming down on me or anything. And, you know, I took a different view of it, and I went back and kept going and made it over that rough spot. But I didn't like the discipline, but as I became more successful, and I made the connection, I realized that, okay, if I want more of this, all I got to do is do more of that. So I just discipline myself more, and I'll get more results.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, we have the luxury now of talking about this later on, like today. So at the time, when all these thoughts and these changes or desires are going through us, for me anyway, I didn't recognize them at the time. Always,
I didn't recognize them either for what they were. I mean, I knew that, for instance, I had a lot of friends who loved to do things outdoors, and they loved to hunt or fish or things like that. And I remember that there'd be a certain time of the year when, you know, they'd all take off doing that, and you know, I went down to the weight room and worked out, and there'd be many days or nights that I was the only one, you know, doing that. And at the time, you know, certainly I questioned the trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't think there really wasn't a deep analysis. I didn't, I really didn't know, certainly if I knew then what I know now, we'd all like to do that again, knowing what we know now.
Yeah. Yeah. So early on, your desire was to, train your body and get bigger or better and be an athlete. Is that correct?
That was it. I mean, again, my uncle was so influential. He was such a sports maniac himself. He was not ever very successful at it, but he just loved it and his whole life. And he, imbued the same thing in me. And, I just had this love affair. And whatever it was, whatever the season was, is baseball, basketball, football, track, whatever it was, then I was doing it. And it was something that I wanted to do and wanted to do more than I wanted to do anything else.
Yeah.
And so, it was an eat, sleep, breathe kind of thing. And mm-hmm. so that was the focus of just about everything that I did.
Well, looking today, it sounds to me like you made a decision and you had the motivation and desire and you made the sacrifices to get the goal you saw in front of you, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's, when I finally began to realize some pretty significant goals, it all kind of came together then. And I could make the connection.
Mm-hmm.
Until you get some success, and I think that's where a lot of people bail out on their goals, is they got this big goal and they never make it to the kind of the first mile marker, the first significant milestone where they have a little bit of success that they can look to and say, okay, the trade-off that I, because there's a price to pay for everything, and
sure,
it doesn't matter what it is, and they don't wait until they get the trade-off. They don't wait until there is a trade-off. All they can see is they're paying the price, and they're not getting anything back. And if you don't have a strong desire, an intense desire, in fact, Hill called it a white hot desire.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have one of those, then you're probably going to bail.
Yeah. Well, after that sacrifice and that hard work and not going hunting and hanging out with the other guys, were you any good? Were you any good in sports?
Well, I ended up getting a college scholarship. I ended up being a high school All-American. So, and I think coming from where I came from, physically, I was a short, fat kid at one point in time, and I grew out of that, and then I started working out, and I was able to condition my body to the point that I was bigger and stronger than most of the people that I went up against. But I hadn't been that way. I mean, there was a time, for a good part of my life, where I couldn't do a push-up. I couldn't do a pull-up. And, then I got to the point where I could do pretty much whatever I wanted to with my body simply because, I had conditioned myself well enough to do it. So, the payoff came.
Mm-hmm.
And that, when it started to come when I started to move up on my team and I started to have some results just on my team, just among the 60 or 70, players on my team. And I began to improve to the point where I could see that there was a payoff.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as we started to compete against other teams and I started to have some success, then I could see the payoff. So there was a point that, I didn't have to wonder whether I was going to get the payoff. It was starting to come.
Yeah. Well, is that, looking back on that, were you already moving into a kind of a leadership position at that time as well? People look up to you because you have made the sacrifices and the payoff's coming. Is that?
I did get some of that. I did earn some of that and enjoy, a leadership position. And it was because, I had literally transformed myself in a fairly short period of time.
Yeah.
I think probably that experience that covered a span of about 7 years probably has done more for me in my life, has carried me farther,
mm-hmm.
because, it first of all instilled a pretty decent work ethic, and I was a really, and it still am, I'm a very lazy person. people look at me sometimes, they go, you're not a lazy person with all that you turn out. And I go, oh, but yeah, yes, I am. You know, at heart, I really am. It's just that I know that to get what I want, you know, I have to get up off the couch and go do something. But I'm really lazy.
Yeah.
But I just get off the couch enough. And that's the important part.
What was going on with you, let's say, on the inside? I don't know if self-esteem is the right term, or is it ego, or how did that work out in those formidable years, I guess, for lack of a better word?
Well, the great news is that my self-confidence was exploding. The bad news is my self-esteem wasn't. And there's a difference. And I never knew that. I mean, it was years before I ever made that connection. And only after a tremendous amount of study did I determine that self-esteem and self-confidence aren't the same thing. Self-confidence is your belief in your ability to do something. Your self-esteem is the way you feel about yourself. And there's two different things, and I'll give you a great example. You take any great sports figure of today who's having trouble. You know, Mike Tyson, how many times has he been in trouble? Mike Tyson has a tremendous amount of confidence as a boxer, but you can tell by everything that he does that he has very low self-esteem. Terrell Owens, tremendous confidence as a football player, as a wide receiver, but terrible self-esteem. He self-destructs and self-sabotages all the time, and self-sabotage and self-destruction is a definite sign of a low self-esteem. What's the actor's name that I can't think of his name now, all the drug problems, and Lindsay Lohan's another one. You know, there's a person who has a tremendous amount of confidence in front of an audience, in front of a camera, tremendous amount of confidence. I mean, amazing amount of confidence that she can transform herself into this role of another person, but she can't stand herself inside. She, as a human being, she has a very low value of who she is. So, you know, I had a very low self-esteem, and I'm not sure, you know, what that was from. Certainly I had a lot of encouragement at home, and that's important. But there's other things that go along with it. You know, a lot of times it comes from people that you associate with. It comes from teachers and, you know, other people that you begin to believe what they're saying about you. And so when you do, that transforms itself into a low self-esteem. And so I'm not sure what the root of it was for sure, but I know I lived with it for many years, and it was it's a common problem in sports, because we're conditioned to develop our self-confidence. There's no coaching, there's no, you know, you don't do any training at all to develop your self-esteem. I believe that you could produce some really superior athletes if you worked on their self-esteem too, but there's no, you know, there's really no formal, that's not happening on a formal basis. Guys like John Wooden, I think, probably were, you know, that's a level of a coach who probably did a lot for his player's self-esteem. I'm just saying from an outside looking in, I never had a personal experience. But I know there's a lot of coaches out there that have done a lot of bad things for a person's self-esteem. If you think and look at the Rutgers coach that's just been dismissed, the basketball coach, I mean, the things he was doing was really, really attacking these players' self-esteem. And unfortunately, in a lot of the sports arena, there are coaches who don't understand that their tactics are demeaning the self-esteem of the players. So, you know, I was in my 40s before, you know, I figured out that I had a low self-esteem.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the reason I had the problems that I did when I was in my 40s was because I had a low self-esteem.
It's wild. I mean, listening to the stories and looking at my own life, and we've had guests on that are, say, actors or public speaking figures in front of thousands of people and that kind of thing. And they tell me they're very introverted. They were terrified of people. It's just wild how that is almost like a duality or whatever.
I am still, most people find this extremely hard to believe, but I am still to this day an introvert. My wife will tell you that I can sit in a room by myself for hours. I'm very happy with who I am, and I'm very happy with myself. And I don't have to be around a lot of people. If I am, great, I can enjoy other people. I'm not a hermit.
Right.
But I'm very definitely introverted. And quite frankly, there's a lot of successful people that I've known who do very extroverted type of jobs, like you're talking about speakers. I know some speakers who are very, if I said their name, you'd know them immediately. They're mm-hmm. huge, you know, they have huge audiences, and yet they are very introverted.
It's remarkable, and I find it fascinating. That's why I love listening to you guys and everybody's stories, because it's a little different all the time, and I guess we all tell in our stories have a different view of things. When we talk about that low self-esteem, what I found for myself, I was telling myself lies most of the time, you know, like, sure. You're not worth it. You're not smart enough. I mean, I'm 5'2", so that thing was going on the whole time. You know, all those excuses but it's real at the time.
Sure.
You know, I'm hearing people say, get a real job. Now, they didn't try to hurt me when they said that, but that could have crushed me. Even you saying your uncle, I believe, the way he gently, when you were ready to quit at one point, he kind of, the way he talked to you, that could have went a completely different direction.
Yeah, that was my stepfather, and he could have taken it a completely different way.
Sure.
He could have
crushed
you. He could have made me feel like I was a coward if I quit, or, you know, whatever, like some people use those tactics, but he didn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, he appealed to a different part of me, and I was able to look at the situation, and I mean, I've thanked him for that. It was a turning point in my life. I mean, when I stop and think about, you come to the where the road forks, and you can go left, you can go right. That was a major, major fork in my life, I can't imagine what my life would have been like if I'd have gone down the other fork.
Yeah, well, it's wonderful that you can look back and see that as a blessing and pay attention, you know, really give value to those things. So
sure.
Sometimes we just don't look.
Sure.
Well, what I got to ask you this, Vic, how'd you sort through, let's say, college, and now you're a, you know, predominant sports figure on the team, and how were you with the girls, and how did you wade through the distractions, let's say?
I didn't. I was distracted. You know, I was a, you know, 19-year-old, 20-year-old,
yeah.
In college, and just like no change, you know, it's the same 40 years ago as it is today. I was distracted.
Yeah.
You know, I had a girlfriend who was a cheerleader, and you know, I wanted to play a lot, and you know, I played as much as I possibly could. So sometimes I played too much.
I always like to ask that again too, and I relate to my guests, you know, from my own life. And it's just, again, it's remarkable how people, one thing about, it seems like sports oriented people, team players and artists seem to have that, they already made the sacrifices, and sometimes that helps them sort through some of those other distractions. Cause like you talked about right from the beginning, the payoff, they know what they're looking for, that payoff, and other things get in the way.
Sure.
So what happened after college? What'd you do?
After college, I went to work for a Fortune 500 company, and I went through a fast-track training program that they had. In fact, I went through a two-year program and finished it in a year, and you know, became the youngest manager in the company, and I worked for them a year in that capacity. And during that time, there was a complete change of upper management, and it happened so swiftly and so suddenly. I looked at that and said, you know, if I were in that position, then it would have happened to me that swiftly and that suddenly, and it was just not a life that I wanted to live. So I said, you know, I'm going to pursue something else. I'm going to go to work for myself. I'm going to be an entrepreneur. And so a guy had approached me because he knew that I was kind of networked in the area, that I talked to a lot of people. And he said, I'm putting my business up for sale. And he said, I think it was 22 years old at the time. The business was a very successful business. And I'm putting my business up for sale. And if you know of anyone who might be interested in buying a business, I'd be interested in talking to them. And I said, okay. So I went home, and all this had just happened with my company. And I, you know, just started thinking, well, you know, maybe I ought to talk to him. So I went back to him and says, look, you know, I've never sold anything in my life, so I don't have any selling experience. And he was in the sales business. I don't have any selling experience. and I don't have any money. You know, I was 21, 22 years old, and I had a car payment. That's what I owned, was a car payment. And I said, if you'll teach me how to sell, if you'll train me how to sell, I'll figure out how to get the money. And I guess he just believed that I could do it. And so he said, yeah, we'll try that. So almost a year and a half later. And he ended up selling the business to me. I borrowed part of the money from a bank, and then he agreed to take the rest in a note. And that's how, you know, I got started. And I've been a serial entrepreneur for the most of the rest of my life. A couple of years after that, I developed the first Quick Lubes in Florida, back when Jiffy Lube only had one unit in Baltimore, Maryland, and we got started about the same time. So I had a real good run in my 20s. I had a lot of energy. I had a great work ethic. And so I just slung a lot of stuff against the wall, hoping some of it would stick. And some of it did. But, you know, again, working all the time back there was this low self-esteem. And you said something earlier about the thoughts that you don't deserve it. And so a lot of what, you know, on the surface, I looked very successful, looked very self-confident. I was serving on a number of local boards, and, you know, I was kind of the wonder kid. But inside, I didn't feel so good. So inside, eventually what you're going to manifest is what's inside. You know, I can look at a person's life, and I can tell in a few minutes what's going on the outside. I mean, excuse me, what's going on the inside, just by looking at what's going on the outside. Mm-hmm. You know, in my case, you know, I ended up, you know, really self-destructing and self-sabotaging and created all kinds of conflicts and problems for my life. And I had a large business, multi-million-dollar business, many employees, but, you know, I was sabotaging myself constantly.
That's wild. So, it's wild you talk about that already in the show, that self-sabotage and that. And I hope you share with us. I'm going to ask you, doing the research you have and coming through that towards today, what was going on? Did you sort out what was at the root of all that?
Well, I mean, there were a lot of things that were at the root of it. But I mean, you know, one of the things is certainly self-esteem. A lot of self-confidence, no self-esteem or low self-esteem. That was part of it for sure. I think that also I didn't have a lot of principles. You know, I had not trained myself in the athletic, you know, in the athletic world has some very narrow principles, and you use those principles in sports and whatever. But you know, you look at universal principles like cause and effect. You know, I didn't really understand nor care about cause and effect. The fact that you reap what you sow, if you want to use other language, another language is more common. I didn't really understand that principle. I didn't really care. So whether it was in my relationships or whether it was in the business decisions that I made, I never made any of those decisions with the idea that I needed to be considering the principle that I'm using, because it's going to, you know, everything is going to manifest itself eventually. And so I built kind of a house of sand, or a house on sand. And, you know, it began to come crashing down in many ways, not just financially, but in many other ways. And my relationships were not very good, were not very strong. And, you know, so basically it took about 20 years from the time that I started to go to the zenith. And I did some other things. I had some other businesses. I got involved in politics and and developed and built a very successful political consulting firm that was doing campaigns for U.S. senators and congressmen and governors and whatever. And, you know, that's a whole nother trip and, you know, a whole nother thing. But again, not built on the right principles. Mm-hmm. And so over a 20-year period of time, I had this phenomenal run, but at the same time, it's really, and I can never see it, but it's really self-destructing all at the same time, even when it appears to be so successful. And so I wake up in my early 40s, and, you know, I was bankrupt mentally, emotionally. I never declared bankruptcy financially. There was no need to. I didn't have anything. I'd lost everything. So there's no need to. I figured there's nothing they can get, so yeah. It's all gone. So, but I was bankrupt in every way in my life, and so I had to. That's what I had to address. That's when I began the study of myself and the principles that life is based on. And they're pretty simple, mm-hmm. And that kind of gave me a new life, a brand new life.
Well, that's a wild piece of story there, Vic. What, you know, what did you do first when, like, that last day when you're completely busted? You intuitively knew to call somebody or ask?
Well, there is no last day. I mean, yeah. You know, there's no last day. There's no first day. There wasn't a day when all of a sudden this is it. I mean, there were certain things that happened for sure. You know, we were evicted from our house at one point. The judge gave us 48 hours to get out, even though I had no place to go. I had no money. Even if I had a place to go, and that's a whole story in itself. Yeah. How I pulled that off, and ended up having my last car repossessed, and it wasn't like it all happened in one day.
Yeah.
There were some magic moments where I grasped some concepts that kind of like the light came on. But there wasn't one day when it all turned around either. There might be one day, I'll tell you about that in a minute. There might be one day I could say it really turned around in my mind, but, you know, physically it didn't turn around in one day. And so it was it took a while for the decline to go its course. And then it took a while as I began to uncover the answer to creating the right kind of life. But I had to lose it all in order to get it to get, I had to lose everything totally, not just physically speaking, mm-hmm. but I had to lose everything in order to start over and build a great foundation. Yeah. And it's like, you know, we live in Florida and we have hurricanes, and I've seen them wipe it out to a house out to the foundation where there's nothing but a foundation. And I would equate my case to, not only did I get wiped out down to the foundation, but the foundation actually got wiped out because there wasn't much of a foundation to begin with.
Yeah.
So when I started rebuilding, then I had to build a foundation too, and that was a process of discovery that took place over a couple of years. You know, there was a lot of grief in there, and there was a lot of denial. And there were a lot of things that took place before I really, I think what we do is we kind of, when we get sick, you know, we want to go take the medicine and it be over.
Yeah.
But it's gonna linger for a while. And you know, I think what I wanted to do is take the pill and it'd be over. And
yeah.
it wasn't going to happen that way. So the pill to me was, you know, I said that in my preteens that somehow I'd gotten attracted to, you know, personal development, not in a intense or deep way, but there was, I did know enough to do some rudimentary goal setting. Mm-hmm. And I was in my early 20s. I remember listening to Earl Nightingale and listening to Zig and Whately and those guys. But then I kind of got away from it. I just kind of left all of that. And by the end of my 20s, I wasn't listening to anything good for you.
Yeah.
And so as I'm trying to figure a way to dig out, I'm kind of drawn back to personal development. So I started doing a tremendous amount of reading. Over a 10-year period, I read over 1,000 books. I became obsessed with trying to figure out what the hell was wrong.
Yeah.
And I did what most people do. For the good part of that period of time, I looked outside myself.
Right.
Because it certainly something outside myself was the problem.
Yeah.
And if I fixed that, I knew if I fixed that, it'd be over with.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while before I'd admit that there was no problem with the outside. The whole problem was on the inside.
Yeah. Well, even reading all those books, I'm guessing most of the authors were telling us that as you were reading it. You just couldn't really process that, right?
You don't want to accept it.
Yeah, can't. Yeah.
Can't accept it.
Can you pinpoint that? You said you had a story come up. I don't know if that was it.
Well, I can tell you, and I don't even remember which book it was that mm-hmm. led me to this. This is probably the biggest day of my life. It's probably the biggest day and the saddest day at the same time. But and I can't tell you which book it was. Probably Emmett Fox, and it was probably Make Your Life Worthwhile, because that book was very influential. As a Man Thinketh obviously was a huge book in my life, but and Magic of Thinking Big by Dr. Schwartz, David Schwartz. But I was probably reading Emmett Fox, Make Your Life Worthwhile. And the idea came to me that I had created all of the mess in my life. And I ran away from it. I did not want to accept that. It was too painful. I mean, I remember when my 13-year-old daughter, when my daughter turned 13, she first day, you know, her, she's becoming a teenager. That's a massive transition. That's a big day in a child's life, but in my little girl's life, my only daughter. And I was so broke that I couldn't even buy her a birthday present. And it was just a sickening, just incredibly bad feeling. And, you know, I thought about the times when the lights had been cut off, phone had been cut off or whatever, and I'm thinking, you know, I would have never created that. I wouldn't want that. But mm-hmm. the longer I thought about it, the more I realized that I had in fact created all of it. And that's when the light came on and this phenomenal power came to me, because I realized that if I did create all of that, if I was responsible for all the crap, then I would also be the responsible for the solution. And then I realized that I am the only one, if I accept the responsibility, I am the only one in charge of my life, and I can create whatever life I want. If I don't accept the responsibility for creating all the crap, then that means someone else or something else is in charge of my life. And I'm always going to be a prisoner to that. And I'm always going to be a slave to whatever that other person or whatever that incident or whatever it deems I should do. But if I accept responsibility, if I say, okay, I take responsibility for all that. I created that, no matter how bad it is, and no matter how much I'd think that I wouldn't want that, I did in fact create that. So if I created that, it means I can create a way out too. And so dealing with the heartache of it all was very, very sad. But the power that I got on that day, it was amazing. I mean, absolutely amazing.
Like a relief and a big responsibility altogether, like you're saying, both very sad and very great, like the greatest.
Empowered. I mean, empowered, yeah. Like beyond belief. I mean, you know, if you're the only person, if you are the only person that is in control of your life, if there's nothing else, it doesn't matter about the economy. It doesn't matter about your spouse. Nothing matters except you and your decisions and your choices and your actions. If you are solely responsible for your life, then you can create whatever kind of life you want to create.
Well, what did you do next? Were you on fire? Did you jump up out of the chair? And what did you do?
I'd want to tell you that we just immediately we changed the screen from black and white to color.
Yeah.
And no, it didn't happen like that.
How did you do it?
Well, it empowered me. And I'm very, very definitely sure that the path now became a lot shorter.
Yeah.
But it did take time. And now I'm looking in the right places. When I'm looking for solutions, I'm not looking outside now, I'm looking inside.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm beginning to break down all of the mistakes that I made. And I should say this, that I learned something along the way too, because most of us have a tendency to want to beat ourselves up over all the mistakes that we made, especially if you got a mistake that you made that resulted in you getting evicted from your house. I mean, that's a hard mistake to live with,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I heard a speaker, and I don't even remember who it was. I wish I could give them credit. But they said something that made a tremendous amount of sense. And they said, there are no mistakes in life, only lessons.
Yeah.
And so I took a different approach to the mistakes I'd made and began to see those as lessons. And I began to dig and say, okay, well, why did I get that result? What caused that result? What created that result? I learned about cause and effect. I learned that, you know, if you do something over here, it's going to have an effect over here. I really grasped that. And Brian Tracy says that cause and effect is the most powerful principle, you know, in the universe. And you stop and think about it, pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to connect all the dots then. And it was another couple of years, you know, I did just as I did not suddenly decline into this place I was in, I didn't all of a sudden come out of it either. But I will say this, I came out of it a lot faster than I got there. And, you know, I've told people that what I learned during that period of time, that, you know, if someone came as for some reason, something happened in my life and they came and took everything away from me today, I could have it back twice as big in half the time. Because I know now what caused it all.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well, but when you're in that, though, tell me about when you're in that, it's hard to see it all the time. When I was living in the park, if you or anybody else, a person I respect and admire, would tell me this could be the greatest experience of your life, and for a lot of other people as well, I'm not buying it. You know what I mean? I can't know that. There's no way to know what's on the other side.
Well, you know, there isn't any way to know, but when you begin to grasp the true principles that work, the principles that the universe are based on, when you begin to grasp those, you begin to incorporate them into your life. Doesn't mean that you use them all the time, because, you know, none of us do, but as you begin to use them and you begin to understand them, the use of them, then there is a certain calm. I remember very clearly when I lost the last car we had, I was fortunate enough. A friend of mine had a 15-year-old bomb. I mean, it was a bomb. It was one of those cars that you pull up, you know, in the old days when they used to put gas in your car. In this case, you'd say, fill it up with oil and check the gas. I mean, burn more oil than gas. And there'd be black smoke billowing out of the back of it going down the road. Well, I drove that because I didn't have any other choice for 15, or I didn't think I had any other choice. That's a better way to say it. I did that for 15 months. And I remember driving down the road one day in this bomb, and I'm a big guy now. I'm 6'4", and this was a small car. And I'm sitting there driving, and I look kind of like Fred Flintstone. You know, if you've ever seen him, it looked like I was wearing the car. And I was driving down the road, and there was just this tremendous calm that I knew that the time was coming, and it wasn't going to be that long. The time was coming that I would see the result of the change that I'd made.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the things were. See, you know, I said earlier that I could tell what's going on in your life inside by looking at what's happening outside. Well, I knew that the changes in my life had already been made inside. I knew that some significant construction had been done on the inside, and that it was only a matter of time before you could see it on the outside. And I knew it was coming. I just believed in the principle. I mean, I believed that it was going to, you know, what was in the inside was going to be manifested on the outside. I just believed it. And so there was a certain calm there. Now, that didn't mean that, you know, that life necessarily was always easier, because, you know, when you're living on the edge, you know, one thing happens, you have a flat tire. That's a catastrophe.
Absolutely.
I mean, a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you have things that happen now. There are things that happen in us, no big deal. You know, back then, you know, it was a catastrophe. Today, it was funny, you know, we had these two huge water heaters. We got this big house, and we weren't getting a lot of hot water. So something's wrong. So the guy comes over, and he said, we have two of these things, and there's one of the elements burned out. And I said to him, I said, well, let's just replace all the elements and just drain the thing and those two things and replace all the elements. He said, sir, those other three are fine. All you have to do is replace that one. I said, yeah, but it's a couple years old, and, you know, let's just do it all now and take care of it, and then we don't have to be inconvenienced again. And he looked at me like I was nuts, you know. The funny thing is I could do that without a thought, whereas 15, 16 years ago, I'd be trying to figure out how I'm going to pay for one element.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, it's just that it's a totally different world you live in. And, you know, so I'm still living in those times where I'm living on the edge, but I'm living on the edge with a confidence now.
Yeah.
That if I just keep doing what I'm supposed to do, that, you know, eventually the principles are going to manifest themselves physically, and they did.
So you really, when you got struck with the notion that you're responsible for your thinking, you're responsible, it set you free, kind of, in a sense.
No question about it.
Yeah. But you did the work, and you paid the price for all that too. But now you have a new direction, correct? You know, you said it, you said the word no, you know that it's going to manifest on the outside. You know it.
Well, I mean, I know the truth of as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. You know,
right.
I mean, that's a proverb. That's the title. As a man thinketh is James Allen's 107-year-old book. That's the first line of his book. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. As a man thinketh in her heart, so is she. Well, I know that's a truth. I know that that's a truth. And Earl Nightingale, he had a play on that, which came from Napoleon Hill. His famous line was, you become what you think about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, same thing as a man. Well, that's true. It is undeniably true. And I know that. So if I feel like I'm moving over into a place that I'm not being creative, that I'm not being positive, that I'm becoming destructive, or that I'm, you know, I'm not using my gifts in the right way, and I'm kind of getting down on myself or feeling sorry for myself, I know what the cure is. I know what the solution is. I got to change what I'm thinking about, because I know that now. I didn't know that in my early 40s, as I'm swirling down the drain.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And most people don't know that. They don't have any idea. And so, you know, I know now where the medicine is. I can just go to the medicine counter, and, you know, I don't have to go through what I went through before, because I can go take the cure right away.
Yeah. It's remarkable to me that a lot of us need to be demolished before we can recognize that, but not everybody. There's a lot of people that kind of know that intuitively from the beginning and work on that. And what's your take on that?
You know, the only person I'll ever know is myself.
Yeah.
I mean, the only person that I'll ever know, I can, you know, I'm very close, obviously, to my wife, and I think that I know a lot about her. And I think she knows a lot about me, but the only person that I can ever know is me.
Mm-hmm.
And the only person that I can ever know really how they feel is me. And, You know, so I don't, I know this, that I know that I look at, I know that there were people that I thought had magical lives.
Yeah.
And I always wished that I had a life like them. This was before I really understood any truths. I had no idea about universal principles, but I saw these people and they had such, appear to be magical lives. And then I watched in almost all those cases, their lives unravel. In one case, a guy who I was jealous of all the time, he ended up taking his life. And so you don't know. You know, I'm sure there's no question in my mind that people looked at me and on the outside and thought, yeah, wow, he's got it made. You know, I'd love to be just like him. Well, they had no idea.
Yeah, that feeds into almost some of the lies we tell ourselves, right? Like I look at somebody else and give myself permission to know how spiritual and how lovely they are, and I don't know anything about them.
You don't know anything about them, and you can't really know anything about them. I mean, you can obviously look at the outside, and you know, if you hang around long enough, you'll see. Like for instance, in my case, I wasn't manifesting a lot of bad things for a long period of time there, but on the inside, it's all growing. And then when it began to manifest, it went very negative, very badly.
Well, once you started working your way out of this, realizing the answer, the solution, the years of work and the more paying the price of that stuff, what did you do next? I mean, how did you get where you are today?
I just applied what I learned. I mean, you know, I applied what I learned to digging my way out. You know, I finally got back to zero. For a long time, I was below zero. It was just to get to back to level ground was a goal. And so when I got back to that point, I still wasn't out of the, you know, I still wasn't out of the woods. And I was at an event in Jacksonville, Florida, in October of 1997, and one of the speakers that evening, she uttered some words that just totally floored me. And the funny thing is, I'd read the words before in a book, but they just never hit me like that. She said, and she was quoting from The Magic of Thinking Big, she said, "The size of your success is determined by the size of your belief." And that hit me, man. That was like, wow, the light came on. That all this time now that I've been rebuilding the foundation, you know, what I was still lacking is the belief. And the funny thing is I never knew that in the, you know, when I'm coming up in sports and when I'm starting out and coming up in business, you know, I never realized that it was my belief back then. I just, you know, I was young enough and stupid enough to believe, and dumb enough to believe that I could do it, you know. A rational, reasonable person would have said, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, when I bought that first business, I had no money. A rational, reasonable person said, you can't do that. But I wasn't rational, reasonable, or, you know, I was young and dumb. And I just said, I read the book, Magic of Thinking Big, back in my early 20s, and Schwartz said you could do it. So I believed him. But I never made the connection then. I was still too young to make the connection. So now I'm 20-something years down the road, and I'm now almost back to zero, not quite. And I heard those magic words, and I realized this is the last piece of the puzzle. You know, you got this huge puzzle. You still can't tell what it is. Got to have this one piece. Well, that was the piece of the puzzle. And so I made a commitment, and I worked harder on this than anything I've ever done in my life. I made a commitment that night that I was going to work harder on my belief than anything I'd ever done. And I went to work for 90 days, and it continued for many months and continues to this day, but for 90 days, I was a man on a mission, obsessed. I mean, I was crazy about changing my belief. And so one of the things I did was I took a look at the truth. So you're talking about the lies that we tell ourselves. And so I told myself a lot of lies, just like most of us do, and I believe those lies. you know. And so I took the truths. I took all the lies I was telling myself, and then I found out what the truth was. And one of the lies, I'll give you a great example, is I don't like to get up in the morning. It's just not something I've ever liked to do. And I'd rather sleep for a while. Now, I stay up later than most people. That may have something to do with it. But I tell people that if God wanted me to see the sunrise, he'd have put it about noon. You know, I mean, I'm just not into it. I live on the east side of the lake, so I can see the sunset. I don't care about seeing the sunrise. All right. Well, this habit of getting up late and everything, I've been criticized for quite a bit of my life by quite a few people pretty close to me, as a matter of fact, about that habit. And I grew up in an agricultural family. What happens in a, you know, family of farmers? You get up at 5:30 in the morning, and the early bird gets the worm, and all these other, you know, early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. I mean, all these things, you know, I was under the belief that one of the problems that I was having being successful was that that I slept late, that contributed to it. Didn't matter that once I got up, I worked a lot harder than most people. That didn't matter. It was this belief that I had that this was a negative belief that I had that was actually manifesting itself. And so I went to work on that, and I started studying famous people. And in the process, I found out that one of my heroes, Winston Churchill, he never got up in the morning. You know, Albert Einstein never got up before noon. I found all these people that had the same habit as I did. And I looked at their success and I go, okay, well, I can check that one off. That's not a reason that I'm failing. What's the next reason I'm not failing? Failing? You know, so what I did was I found all these truths and I created what I call truth cards. And it was to reverse all of the lies. And the number one truth card that I had was, I can do this and I know I can. Or you can do this and you know you can. You can do this and you know you can. And I wrote these cards. I didn't have extra money, so I found some old business cards that I had, and I X'd out the face of them, and I turned them over on the back, and I'd write a truth on each one of the business cards. The number one truth I had was, you can do this, and you know you can. And I had this stack of them. There was almost 52. It was like a deck of cards. It was almost 52 of them. And I put a rubber band around it, and I made two sets. I had a set in my car, and I had a set at my desk. And going through the day, I'd sit at my desk, I'd unwrap those cards, and I'd take and I'd verbally say the truth. I'd get into it. I'd visualize. I'd do whatever. And I would impress that truth upon my subconscious. I'd get in my car. I'd come to a stoplight. I'd grab those cards. I know people looked over in my car and saw me talking to myself. I really couldn't care less. They were probably laughing at that little car I was driving, but you know, it didn't matter. I was on a mission. So I don't know how many times a day, I mean, hundreds of times a day, I affirmed the truth. And I began, and one thing that you have to do when you affirm the truth is you have to live it. You can't just say it. You have to live it. So one thing that I've always had a negative belief about was that I never had enough time. I was always late, running late. I was always stressed out. You know, I was always down to the last minute on everything. And, you know, I realized that's not the truth. The truth is that I always have enough time to do everything I need to do. I don't have enough time to do everything I want to do. I'll never have enough time to do everything I want to do. But I always have enough time to do everything I need to do. And so I started saying that, and what would happen is now all of a sudden I'm in a calm situation. I'm running out of time, and I'm saying that affirmation, and I'm not just saying something. I'm also living it, and a tremendous calm would come over me, and I lost the stress. I would actually realize that, hey, there's nothing. I'm going to make it. I always have enough time to do everything I need to do. I still use that today. It comes automatically now because I've done it so much. But when I feel the press or stress of time, I say, look, you've always got enough time to do everything you need to do. And so I did that for 90 days. And amazing things began to happen in that 90 days. People, all of a sudden, opportunities that, you know, I thought were non-existent. They began to make themselves available, people that all of a sudden came into my life. And, you know, I had made $14,027. That was my total gross pay income in 1997 for a family of five, qualified below the U.S. poverty level. And the next year, so 90 days, things are beginning to happen. By the time that year ended, so it took me about 1 year, and I was into six figures. I went from a little over $14,027 over six, and, you know, over $100,000 that year. And then it was just a handful of years later that I'm now in creating a seven-figure income. Mm-hmm. So all of that, you know, came from that same exercise. And, you know, I had to change the belief. That was my piece of the puzzle. Not the same piece for everyone, but it's a big piece for a lot of people.
So, Vic, in that whole story, telling me that you were non-successful because you slept till noon. You weren't being successful because you believed that's the reason.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Dennis Whately said one of the most remarkable things. It's just remarkable. He said, it's not what you are that holds you back. It's what you think you're not.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Because that's exactly true. We run around thinking that these things that we see as handicaps are holding us back. That's just not true. You know, and I challenge audiences, you know, so I don't care what, you know, kind of handicap you think you have. You share with me what you think handicaps you, what's holding you back. Share that with me. And I'll show you someone who's achieved what you want to achieve with the very thing you're saying is holding you back. Don't ever, if you're sitting in my audience, don't ever tell me you have ADD and that's why you're not successful.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have ADD. And I know a number of other, in fact, it is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
It is a tremendous gift. And, you know, I've shared with my audiences that, you know, that what makes special people special is just that they're ordinary people who have done something extra ordinary, but they're really just ordinary people.
Vic, how did you change your vision, or how did it come about that you got the idea to share your message with everybody else? Or was that kind of going on throughout this whole process?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, you know, I had not even thought about it. I mean, I'm obviously a huge student. I actually met, he had a tremendous influence on me, Charlie Tremendous Jones. I know you were talking, so you're going to see his daughter next week. I met Charlie, and God bless him. I mean, he sold me my first copy of As a Man Thinketh, and that was remarkable, and just blessed to have known him and was able to speak on the same stage with him a number of years later. But, you know, I'm sitting there thinking this internet thing's going to be big. This is in the late 90s. I'm thinking this is going to be big. And, you know, where am I going to play on? You know, what can I do on the internet? Where can I play at? And I started looking around, and of course, my friend David Ricklin, he had been out there with selfgrowth.com since about 96, I think. And our friend Kyle Wilson had been out there since 99, I believe. And, you know, so I'm thinking, personal development, that might be a good area. And I went back to that book, As a Man Thinketh, and I said, and I knew it was in the public domain. I knew that no one had the rights to that. The public has the rights to that. And I said, I wonder if that domain name's available. And I went and got it. I had no idea what I was going to do with it, but I went, asamanthinketh.com was not available. It was taken, but no one was using it. Well, they weren't doing anything with it. And I just gambled. There, at that time, if you remember, there was only three, there were only three types of domains, .net, .com, and .org. There was no, none of these .biz, .info, none of that. And so I said, well, maybe .net. There were a couple of companies that had made .net work for them. And I said, maybe I can brand it as a man thinking .net. So I went ahead and got the name. And 6 months later, it all kind of came together and came up, developed the idea that we'd just give away a copy of the book. And then for all those people that raised their hands and said, give me a copy, then we began to share other resources with them that we had used personally. And that's how our business began to grow. And then, make a longer story short, about 3 years later, I just put a back order in for asmanthinkit.com because it still wasn't being used. And 1 year came along and whoever owned it didn't renew it. And GoDaddy grabbed it for me. And so I've owned it now 6 or 7 years. It comes straight to our existing site. I've never ever built the name out. It's just a redirect. But that's kind of how we ended up in personal development. And you know, I didn't know anybody in personal development. You know, I'd met Charlie, but I mean, I was just somebody in the audience, just like everyone else. And I'd met Jim Rohn, and you know, I was in Bob Proctor's coaching program, but none of these people knew who I was. And you know, so I kind of started out totally unknown, but I had some great, you know, I had some great teaching and great training, and so that helped me get started and helped me grow it.
You know, some of the great training you had, though, was as your house was crumbling down, too, right?
Sure. Absolutely.
That's wild. How many of those books have you given away to date, you think?
Oh, I don't. I mean, I stopped counting when we went over 400,000. I don't have any idea. And of course, I know that the books that we give away, there's a viral thing to them because I know some of those have been passed along and whatever. And you know, I don't have any idea, but it's, you know, at one point in time, I guess in the first couple of years, I pulled a report and something like 170 countries that people had downloaded that book. And it was just, that was so humbling. I got an email, and this still, you know, stop thinking about it, still chokes me up. I got an email from a guy that and this was, you know, in the early years, and he said that he lived in Africa and he rode his donkey. He didn't have any electricity. He rode his donkey to a town once a week so that he could get on the internet, and he didn't own a computer. I guess he was using a public computer. And that he had downloaded that book, and he was telling me how it had impacted his life. And it just, you know, amazed me that I would never meet that guy, probably. And just by me, the act of me going out and giving something away that has this tremendous value could have such a huge impact on someone halfway around the world. And, you know, that's a very humbling experience.
And then what about the feeling you get from that? That's the payoff.
Just right? Humbling. Yeah. It's a great feeling, but it's a humbling feeling. I mean, you know, sure. It's like, oh my God, you know, that's just, it's mind blowing.
Yeah.
And,
Vic, we're running out of time here. Man, it goes fast. What are you up to today, and how can people, you know, stay in tune with what you're doing?
Well, we're still doing a lot of personal development. We're training people. We got 10 websites. We do different things. We got a daily quote website. We got a goals website. You know, we got a publishing company. Last year we published over 60 books, and people that have never read As a Man Thinketh, they can download a free copy from asamanthinketh.net. That's a must-read book. It's 26 pages, the most powerful 26 pages in literary history. I remember when I bought that book from Charlie, I bought this bag of books from him. he was promoting them at this event. And there, I don't know how many, but you know how much Charlie loved books. And he brought these bags, and they were full of books, 30, 40 books in them. And he had this outrageously low price. And I didn't have a lot of money at the time, but I looked in those bags and I said, well, there's a couple of books that I, right there. I mean, there's Bob Burke's book, Endless Referrals, and I've been wanting to buy it. And I found a reason enough to justify buying that bag. And I took it home and I pulled out all the big important books, you know, I wanted to read. And I stuck the rest of them just up on the shelf and with no thought I'd ever read them. And one day I'm up there and I'm looking for something to read. And this tiny little thin little book is on the shelf that was in that bag. I had never heard. I was in my 40s. I had never heard of As a Man Thinketh. And I pulled that book off the shelf, and I began to read it. And it was in the evening, early evening, and I finished it maybe at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. It wasn't, because it doesn't take long to read it. And I highlighted the heck out of it. And I was just, I could hardly sleep. It was so eye-opening, I could hardly sleep. So the next day, the evening rolls around, I do the same thing. I read it again. This time I highlight in a different color marker. And I get through with it, and again, I'm going, oh, my gosh, I can't sleep. And the third day, I did the very same thing. I read it 3 days in a row, marked it up each day. By the time I got through, there was hardly a word that wasn't marked in that book.
Yeah.
And that's just how powerful it is. Almost every single sentence by itself is a huge piece of wisdom. And, you know, so people that hadn't read that book, I can encourage you to get a free copy, asamanthinketh.net. And then the other thing that a lot of people today, due to our economy and everything, looking for ways to create income, other sources of income, backup income, retirement income, et cetera. I started teaching people how to do what I do, and that's to make money from e-books. And I've been doing it for a long time. I'd been doing it long before Amazon Kindle ever came along. But we've embraced that, and I've got a book that we just put up at Amazon. It is now today number 2 in authorship, the authorship category, and number 1 in the direct marketing category. And we haven't even really started promoting it yet, but it's called How to Write a Book This Weekend, Even If You Flunked English Like I Did. And that book will go on special next. It's only not where we got it at an introductory price right now at 99 cents. That's not the regular price. It will go up after the promotion period, but next Wednesday from the 10th to the 14th, you can download it free. 99 cents isn't much, and we've already had a ton of people download it at 99 cents, but for those who want to wait until it's free, April the 10th through April 14th, and you can get it from Amazon for free, How to Write a Book This Weekend, Even If You Flunked English Like I Did. I actually wrote that book in a weekend. I've used that strategy a couple of times for a couple of my books, and so I decided to share with other people how I do it, and I actually wrote that book on a weekend. So anyone that doubts whether they can do it, I absolutely know you can, and I'll give you the step-by-step way to do it.
That's good information. That's next Wednesday that starts, correct? Even
yep.
though I guess we can come off the 99 cents today, right?
Yeah,
I
mean, if you want to cough up 99 cents today, you can do it this weekend. You don't have to wait till next week.
Listen, Vic, it's been such a joy listening to your story. I've been looking so forward to this. Let me ask you, how's Lisa doing?
She's doing fantastic. We have my daughter turns 30 tomorrow, and we have a big birthday party here for a lot of family members and friends coming in. So Lisa's, or not tomorrow, but Sunday. So Lisa's getting prepared for that. So she's getting the house in party mode.
Well, listen, I want you, if you would please, thank her for giving you up for an hour and a couple of minutes.
Well, Todd, we appreciate what you're doing, man. You got a great thing out there. You're delivering the message to a lot of folks. So we were proud of you.
No, thank you so much. It's my pleasure. It really is. Having people like you and all our guests talk directly to me is really an honor. It really is. I really have learned a lot since I started this. There you have it, Vic Johnson. What a guy, man. Real charismatic, I guess is the word. And, you know, he is bigger than life almost. I never met him in person, but I could tell he was a mountain of a man and just a real, genuine, really nice guy, man. He was more than willing when I asked him to be on the show, and I just really value that. I value all his information, all his experience, all his life lessons. Again, Vic Johnson, and that's asamanthinketh.net. You can get there, and you can get to all the other sites from there, too, I believe. You can get the book for nothing. Download it for free, asamanthinketh.net. Well, we're out of time again. It's been another great show. Thank you, everybody, for listening, or the people that are going to listen through the archives. We really appreciate all the support. Thanks again, everybody. Until next time, make it a great day.